Current State on WKAR. I'm Melissa Benmark, sitting in for Mark Bayshore. I am, of course, the other MB. Thanks for joining us today for the show. Opportunities for people with disabilities have undergone a radical transformation in the past four decades, especially when it comes to education. Before the 1970s, students with special needs were often segregated from their peers if they were even in school. Federal legislation changed that and mandated that public schools move special needs students into regular classes. But some advocates and parents worry that many schools are failing when it comes to supporting those students. Michigan Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly recently gathered feedback from thousands of parents of kids with special needs. And one of the major concerns raised was the tactics teachers and other school employees used when it came to dealing with disruptive behavior from those students. Here to talk to us about how well schools are serving kids with special needs is Elmer Serrano, Executive Director of Michigan Protection and Advocacy Services. Welcome.
Thank you.
And we're also joined by Summer Ferrari, Assistant Professor in MSU's Special Education Program. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Elmer, first of all, special education has changed a lot over the past several decades. Where children with any kind of physical or intellectual disability might have been kept just in one classroom, there's now a lot greater emphasis on integrating those children into mainstream classrooms. So what is a day like in school for a student in special education nowadays?
Well, it depends what school district, first of all. There's still a lot of segregated classrooms, and the assumption that for whatever reason, kids with disabilities have to be segregated or somehow pulled out. Even some of the original attempts at mainstreaming and integration were short-sighted. They were the student with a disability was always a guest in the classroom rather than really being included. And when you look at approaches to universal design in architecture, some of the approaches now, can we have universal design in educational curriculum so that all kids are learn in a common environment? We're not there yet. There's a lot of work that has to be done. But right now, many kids are fully included in the regular classroom, and the curriculum is accommodated to help them learn at their pace.
Students in special education have something called an individualized education plan, or IEP. So what's laid out in that plan?
Everything. It has all the goals. All kids should have an IEP. We should tailor the educational outcomes to the kid's learning style, their ability to grasp the information. It should be individually designed for each kid. That's what it is for special ed. It should be that way for all students.
And who goes into the process of designing this? Whose input?
The parents, the individual, the kid, the student themselves, the teachers, the counselors, whoever is necessary to really who know the kid and know how they can learn and how to build that plan. The problem is then implementing the plan and having some outcome measurable outcomes.
Summer, as I mentioned earlier, Michigan Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly recently held some public hearings to get feedback about Michigan's special education system, and one of his recommendations to the State Board of Education was to end the use of restraint and seclusion for students with disabilities. Can you explain to us what those terms mean?
Well, seclusion is removing the student from all aspects of the classroom and individuals, and so they can be physically confined into a different space. And restraint kind of takes two different forms. One might be physical restraint, where they're literally held down onto the ground, or mechanical restraint, and that is where devices are used to restrain the movement of head, torso, arms, legs, whatever it may be.
Do we know how common the use of either of those methods are for Michigan students in special education programs?
That's one of the biggest problems, is that we don't have good information on that. The use of that, there are guidelines and policies in place for using that, but they're not necessarily implemented with fidelity, and we definitely don't have data to give us good information about who's using it and how often.
Can I just add that there's no reporting requirements and there are no laws against it? And some of the restraint seclusion that's used in schools are things that would never be tolerated even by the parent. Parents are not informed when their child is restrained or secluded, and there's no reporting requirements. Lieutenant Governor Kelly is addressing this and wants to have state legislation. There are regulations from the State Department of Education, but they're voluntary. He really would prefer to have requirements that there at least be a reporting requirement.
There's some legislation, both at the federal and state level, that deals with public schools' responsibilities toward children with disabilities. Are there any regulations or guidance around behavior management in those laws?
When the behaviors related to the disability, the individual educational plan, the IEP that you mentioned earlier, should have reflected that these are the triggers that will set off the behaviors. These are the appropriate interventions. And there are ways to deal with it. I know that Summer has information about the appropriate use of interventions rather than restraint and seclusion.
How does Michigan compare to other states when it comes to educating students with disabilities?
Michigan's the only state that has special education entitlement from birth to 26. Every other state, the federal government requires to age 21. The problem that I see is that at 18, all your age-appropriate peers disappear. They all graduate or leave, and kids with special needs are stuck in the school building for another several years with no positive outcome.
Summer, you spent some time as a classroom teacher as well as a special ed consultant in schools. What did you see in those classrooms regarding how these students were doing?
I've been in the classroom in a lot of different capacities, and so typically when I come in as a consultant, I'm called in because it's an emergency. There's a crisis in the classroom, and so the exact times that I've been in the classroom in those scenarios, it's not being conducted in the way that we would hope that it would be. So in a lot of different ways, teachers just need the information. So they're very willing to implement it and use the techniques. They just need some training sometimes.
Summer Ferrari is an assistant professor in the special education program at MSU's College of Education. We're talking about the push to make changes in the state's special education system. We're also joined today by Elmer Serrano, executive director for Michigan Protection and Advocacy Services. Elmer, how do we compare with other states in terms of serving students with disabilities? I mean, are there any states that really everybody looks to and says they're really doing it well?
Boy, that's a good question. And, you know, I mentioned that Michigan has a longer period of time up through the age of 26, but the results are still the same. Whether you leave school at 18 or 21 or 26, has a student really been prepared for work in the community? And, you know, when you look at even with attempts to integrate classrooms and to have mainstreaming, we still do segregate kids with special needs throughout the 26 years of education. And then when they leave, we say, well, now you need to be integrated in the community and work, you know, in integrated setting. But we've never prepared them for that. So it's, I wish I could say, yeah, there's one model out there that really is great and everybody should do that. But there isn't. It's a work in progress.
Summer, what kinds of support are available to Michigan students in special education when they are integrated into the mainstream classroom?
It varies. It depends on the district and it depends on the resources that are available. One thing that is incredibly helpful is to have a board-certified behavior analyst. That's a BCBA. They are highly skilled and trained in being able to support the behavior management, the academic skills, social skills of students with special needs. And in Michigan, we are in dire need of BCBAs. When you talk about comparing it to different states, Florida, for example, has 2,200 BCBAs. Still not enough for the amount of students we have with special needs. But in Michigan, we have about 335 BCBAs. My area of expertise is typically children with autism. We have 14 to 16,000 students with autism in Michigan schools alone, and about 330 people who have a BCBA credential that can actually go into schools and provide supports in that manner.
Wow. A big part of your research, I understand, focuses on behavior management, how to help students with IEPs in the classroom succeed academically by reducing the kinds of behavior that, frankly, might get them kicked out of class. Can you talk to us about what a successful behavior management plan for those students would look like?
One of the most common things that we look at is called Positive Behavior Intervention Supports. It's PBIS model, and it's a school-wide model where we look at changing the social culture of the school so that basically the rules, the expectations, the interventions that are in place are standard across the school. From the lunchroom teacher to the recess supervisor to the special education teacher, everyone is on the same page. And so that type of program lends itself to great outcomes for not just behavior, because once you can reduce behavior, you have great gains in academics as well. So that specifically is a type of program that's used. About 17,000 schools across the nation have been successful using that.
One thing I'm wondering, and either one of you is welcome to take this, is does it tend to be better in a larger school where there might be more kids and more resources, or a smaller school where there aren't as many kids competing for the resources that are there? I mean, does size have anything to do with how this is handled?
I don't think that the size of the district or the school really makes a difference. The difference is the application of positive behavioral supports, especially when you have a kid that has, you know, a disability and they have an individual educational plan. You know some of the characteristics of the disability. What happens, though, and we've had two children die in Michigan from inappropriate restraint. If the behavioral supports aren't there and the behaviors are related to the disability, we're not talking now about kids that come in that create a danger to themselves or others. In those situations, those emergency situations, you do have to intervene. You don't call an IEP meeting. But if it's related to the disability, you better figure out what triggered it and build it into the IEP as far as the behavioral supports, and really start addressing the problem a lot sooner.
I can add a little bit to that. We did a statewide study across the state of Michigan where we looked at the type of programming that was in place for students with autism, and we got a lot of information about geography and SES and that sort of thing. And we do see some need for additional services in those rural areas, especially when you think about the Upper Peninsula. So it may not be the size of the district, just as Umar said, but it may be related to the location in terms of being able to access, you know, school psychologists and speech and language therapists and occupational therapy and all the things that all the type of wraparound services that occur for special education students.
And I think it's important also not to say we just need to improve special education services. Education services in general need to be improved.
Elmer, in addition to the recommendation to end restraint and seclusion for students in special education, our Lieutenant Governor also made some other recommendations to the State Board of Education, including developing a more transparent and inclusive rulemaking process and supporting parents with better resources. Obviously, that's come up. Do you agree with those recommendations, and how could the state implement them?
Absolutely, I agree. Lieutenant Governor Calley has been absolutely wonderful on this. He's also a parent and is very familiar with the issues impacting kids with special needs. One of the problems I see is that we talk about resources all the time. There are over 800 school districts in Michigan, all with their own superintendents and assistant superintendents, all the bureaucratic structures. We need to make sure that we don't throw the teachers under the bus as far as giving them the resources, making sure that they have the resources to really do the appropriate behavioral supports.
Summer, a lot of your research has focused on teacher training. How much do aspiring teachers learn about working with students with disabilities and behavior management while they're learning to be teachers? I mean, could the schools that specialize in education, teacher training, be doing more to change these practices?
It was one area that we looked at within the research study across the state of Michigan, where we looked at where the teachers came from, what type of training they had, and as everything else, we've learned that it just depends on the university that they come from. Everyone has a different philosophy and a different approach. There are some universities that don't take a behavioral approach, and so they don't receive any classroom management. What I definitely can tell you is that typically general educators, they have students with disabilities in their classroom all the time, and they are the least likely to get any training in behavior management and classroom management. So sometimes a special educator might have one or two classes on it, which is helpful, but not enough. But a general educator might not have any.
Well, we want to thank you both for joining us today. We've been hearing from Summer Ferrari. She's an assistant professor in MSU's special education program, and Elmer Serrano, the executive director of Michigan Protection and Advocacy Services. We've been talking about how well our schools are serving kids with special needs. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Current state on WKAR, the world of academia can be serious and sometimes, dare we say, even stuffy. UC Davis professor Carl Shapiro was known for expressing irreverence toward that stuffiness in his poems. Our public poetry announcement this week is one of Shapiro's poems that was inspired by Sproul Hall, where the English department at UC Davis was housed. Here is MSU Center for Poetry director Anita Skeen reading The Humanities Building by Carl Shapiro.
All the bad Bauhaus comes to a head in this gray slab, this domino, this plinth, standing among the olives or the old oak trees, as the case may be, and whatever the climb. No bells, no murals, no gargoyles, but rearing like a fort with slits of eyes suspicious in the aggregate, its tons of concrete, glaciers of no known color, gaze down upon us. St. Thomas More, behold the Humanities Building. On the top floor are 1.5 professors of Greek, kicked upstairs but with a better view, and 2 philosophers and assorted Slavies. Then stacks of language coming down, mainly the mother tongue and its dissident children, history has a building all its own, to the bottom level with the secretaries, advisors, blue-green photographic light of many precious copying machines, which only the girls are allowed to operate. And all is bathed in the cool fluorescence from top to bottom, justly distributed lights, innovation, progress, equity. Though in my cell I hope and pray not to be confronted by a student with a gun or a nervous breakdown, or a girl who closes the door as she comes in. The old guard sits in judgment and wears ties, eyeing the new in proletarian drag, where the assistant with 1 lowered eyelid plots against tenure, dreaming of getting it. And in the lobby, under the bulletin boards, the Baudelairean forest of posters for transcendental meditation, Audubon Group, the Hunchback of Notre Dame, Scientology, Arab Students Co-op, Case of the Curious Bride, 2 students munch upon a single sandwich.
That was The Humanities Building by Carl Shapiro, read by MSU Center for Poetry director Anita Skeen. Our public poetry announcements are produced in partnership with the MSU Center for Poetry. It's Current State on WKAR. In 2003, former Governor Jennifer Granholm launched the Cool Cities Initiative to spur growth and investment in Michigan cities. One response to the initiative was Scene Metro Space, a community art and performance space in East Lansing. The city closed the space last April, but recently announced an agreement to reopen with MSU heading programming and operations. And with us to talk about the space now is Jacqueline Sullivan, Director of Galleries at MSU. Jacqueline, welcome to Current State.
Thank you for having me.
We are now going to talk about art on the radio.
Wonderful.
Why did Scene Metro Space close in April?
It's my understanding that the city was just looking for a partner to help fund the space. Financially, they just needed a little bit of assistance.
And how did MSU get involved with that?
The city approached the Department of Art, Art History, and Design and just asked if we would be interested in partnering with them. And after many city council meetings, on July 2nd, they decided that it was a go. And July 6th, the university signed an agreement with the city so that we could partner in running and operating the space.
What kind of changes were made to the space for this reopening?
A lot of the changes that we made during the time that we were closed over the summer had specifically to do with the space itself. We updated a lot of the lighting. We added some sort of shifted walls so that we had a little bit more flexibility in how we could display art. And maybe the biggest impact is that we put a brand new floor in, which made the space a lot brighter and more inviting.
Nice. It was initially in a different location. I've kind of lost track. Where did it start and where did it end up?
So originally, it was actually located on Abbott Road, just across the street from Dublin Square. And in 2007, they moved it to 110 Charles Street, right next to Giorgio's. We actually share an entrance with them, as well as all of their wonderful pizza smells. And it's been operating there ever since.
We're speaking with Jacqueline Sullivan, Director of Galleries at MSU, about Scene Metro Space. It's just reopened under MSU's direction. So now that MSU is overseeing operations, what will the programming be like?
So a lot of the programming we're hoping will stay relatively similar to what was happening in the past. We're going to continue to have art exhibitions that run for about 6 weeks at a time. They'll be themed exhibitions. They'll feature artists working in our community as well as artists working in other communities. One misconception is that we're just going to show student art, and we have spaces for that. This is a space to show the community. In addition, we're also hoping that we can shine a light on Scene Metro Space, not just in our community, but by having open calls that feature artists regionally and nationally. We can bring other artists into our community and send our artists out into theirs.
How do you think the changes with MSU's guidance and that kind of thing will affect attendance and participation at Scene Metro Space?
I think that we're hoping to still hit the big crowd that they were hitting before. We want to engage the community as much as possible. But I think by having MSU involved, we are going to draw more students to the space. I think we're also going to draw more faculty participation, which can only help.
I found myself wondering and I've lived in this town for close to all my life, people who didn't usually seem to be that interested in visual art have kind of gotten, it seems, revitalized with the opening of the Broad Museum. Do you think that that's helping make some of the smaller art facilities more of a draw?
Definitely. I think that with the opening of the Broad Art Museum, MSU sort of made a point that art is a part of this university and it's something we want to highlight. So by engaging with the community in a space that is actually off campus that crosses Grand River, we're hoping that we can continue to grow that excitement and that enthusiasm for arts in East Lansing and the greater East Lansing community.
So tell us a little bit about the current exhibit. What's the theme of that?
So our first show is called Place in Proximity, and it features artists from Michigan, Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. We had roughly 73 artists submit work for the show and about 400 actual art pieces submitted for consideration. We were fortunate enough to engage with an alumni from the art department. His name is Dustin London, to be our juror for the show. And he selected 26 pieces and 19 artists from across those four states to be a part of this first inaugural exhibition.
That's a lot of response. How did you get the word out to the artists who submitted?
A lot of emails. A lot of social media and a lot of reposting of the call and just trying to hit as many different types of outlets for folks who look for exhibitions to participate in.
Describe some of the works that are featured in this exhibit.
I think one of the most exciting parts about this show is that because the only theme was where you're from, we have a really diverse makeup in this exhibition, and not only in medium, but in content and in sort of conceptual arrangements of pieces. We have painting, photography, sculpture and drawing, and even a video piece, all the way down to a 3D printed palm tree that sits in front of a video that plays a loop of waves. And we have artists that are not just community artists, but students from across those four states, as well as faculty and just professional artists. So it's a really wonderful mix-up that we gave our juror quite the challenge to try and wrangle. We did this This show was juried through a blind process, which means that the juror knew the titles of the artworks, the medium, the scale, and had an artist statement, but he didn't know names and he didn't know where anyone was from. So that made the show sort of even more exciting to see how this could all work together.
How long does this exhibit run?
The show is open until October 30th. We decided that it would be a good idea to not have a student sitting in the gallery on Halloween. We all know what East Lansing looks like on Halloween.
Well, you heard what happened at Art Prize this week, too, right?
Oh, geez, no.
Someone had a display with that included beads and necklaces, and apparently people thought that they were for them. So,
oh, yeah.
That stay tuned for more on that story. I don't know how that all ends up, but it was participatory to say the least. I understand that there's a new juried exhibit being released this week. What will that one be like?
That one is going to be a national call. That one's going to be featuring artists that make work on a small scale so that we can include more artists in the exhibition and so we can encourage artists to view work in a slightly different way. So this work is meant to be viewed up close and personal, and we're excited that our juror for this show is going to be Professor Jaewon Lee from the Department of Art, Art History, and Design.
We've been speaking with Jacqueline Sullivan, Director of Galleries at MSU, about the reopening of Scene Metro Space. Jacqueline, we thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up on Current State, governors and environmentalists from around the region are gathering in Chicago this week to discuss Great Lakes issues. We'll check in with commentator Gary Wilson about the topics getting the most attention for September's Great Lakes Month in Review. Plus, the Jackson Symphony Orchestra kicks off its concert season this weekend with a performance entitled Joy and Sorrow. Current State's Jamie Paisley talks with maestro Stephen Osmond, as well as the Jackson native cellist he's bringing back to town. That and more coming up after the break. It's Current State here on WKAR. Well, the who's who of the Great Lakes community is gathered in Chicago for the yearly Great Lakes Week. It's a series of conferences that bring together government officials and environmentalists to talk about the region's most pressing environmental issues. Great Lakes commentator Gary Wilson is in Chicago for the event, and he joins us now for September's Great Lakes Month in Review segment. Gary, welcome back to Current State.
Hey, Melissa. Good to be back with you. Thank you.
It's been a while. Yeah. There are two conferences happening this week. The first is the Great Lakes Commission. That's the 60-year-old organization of government officials from the Great Lakes states and two Canadian provinces. What was at the top of the agenda for the folks at that conference?
Yeah, sure, Melissa. The commission, as you said, represents the governors of the eight states and two provinces. And whenever this is a traveling conference, so it goes to different locations in the region each year. And wherever they go, they try to, as best as they can, localize the agenda. And this is Chicago, the Chicago River connecting eventually to the Mississippi and through what is known as the Chicago Waterway System. And that is the primary vector for Asian carp. So Asian carp is at the top of the agenda. The representatives from the other states are sitting here anxiously waiting for updates from Chicago and other regional officials on the status of the carp, I attended a long session yesterday where they got a number of briefings about what's happening. And secondarily, we're still in algae season. Algae is still a big issue. Lake Erie's having a near record year with algae, and everybody still remembers the Toledo water problems from last year. So algae is also near the top of the agenda, and I think we can expect these two topics to be close to the top of most Great Lakes agendas for some time.
I understand you talked to two of the top officials, John Allen, who heads up the Office of the Great Lakes in Michigan, and Tim Eder, who's executive director of the commission in Ann Arbor. What did they have to say about the Asian carp advance and Chicago's waterways?
Well, this is still, as I said, the top of the agenda. You know, last year I interviewed Michigan Governor Snyder about this issue. He was visiting Chicago, and he expressed concern over a lack of urgency on the issue, and there was a lack of consensus, he felt, on what to do. And I asked John Allen what were the governor's sentiments at this point, and Allen indicated that, you know, the governor is a chief executive. Chief executives are not known for their patience when they're waiting for something to happen that's important to them. But Allen did say while there's no plan, there's no consensus on a long-term plan, both he and Tim Eater wanted to express to the region that there has been progress made on a shorter-term plan in an area called the Brandon Road Lock, which is downstream from Lake Michigan. And there's good consensus that that could be a choke point. All the parties in the region agree that it's something that can be addressed. It doesn't have to cost a lot of money, money always being a big hurdle. So there has been progress on what to do there. But on the bigger picture about physical separation of the Great Lakes from the Mississippi River system, no, the various sides are all entrenched in their original positions.
I wondered about that because it does seem like this is kind of perpetually at loggerheads. Anybody else at this conference that you've heard with anything at all, I don't know that innovative is the right word, but unusual as far as the Asian carp question?
No, I think you know, pretty much what is has been known, you know, is still the working material. As I've attended not only this conference but other conferences earlier this year, the issue of eDNA, which really set all this off in 2009, when the Notre Dame scientist using this new technology at the time, environmental DNA. Triggered all the alarms on Asian carp. I detect that has, while still viable, it's drifted into the background a little bit, and I think that's because while they get a lot of positive eDNA hits, the various agencies haven't been able to find many, if any, live fish. So it's sort of like trench warfare. You just got to keep on doing what you're doing.
You mentioned the algae season and, of course, Lake Erie, record algae bloom this year. In the spring, Governor Snyder and Ohio Governor Kasich pledged to reduce the algae caused by phosphorus runoff from agriculture by 40% in 20 years. Any next steps from anybody on how that will work?
Well, that's what everybody's waiting for. Everybody was very excited to hear the two governors make that commitment. What was in short supply was how are we going to get there? I think both Allen and Eater would say that there's no silver bullet. This is going to take time and energy by all parties, agriculture, municipal water systems. Everybody has to be brought to the table and make a commitment to this. The big thing that those two executives emphasized is that everybody now has bought into the fact that they're part of the problem. You know, for years, farmers, you know, were kind of saying, "Hey, we're great stewards of the land; it's not us." But they can't get away with that anymore. So they know that they have to be part of the solution, and they're willing to do that. Now, the question with them is always, how much will they really commit? When it's when they're doing it on a voluntary basis versus being required to do it, so things are going forward, and hopefully they'll move quicker than slower, as Governor Snyder likes to see.
There's an economic impact of the algae problem in Lake Erie as well. The Cleveland Plain Dealer reported this week that the Lake Erie charter boat industry has lost 25% of its business and a whole bunch of goodwill as well. And they're comparing the economic situation to that of the Gulf after the BP oil spill. They might even seek federal assistance. What was the reaction of Allen and Eater to that characterization?
Well, they share the concern, as everybody does. You know, Lake Erie has a world-class fishery, literally People come from all over the world to fish for walleye in the waters of Lake Erie, and that fishing industry is, all the tourism that goes with it is just taking a devastating hit. Both Alan and Eder share the concern. Everybody shares the concern. But, you know, we got ourselves into this mess, and unfortunately, it's, as John Allen said, it's just not going to be resolved overnight. It's rather heartbreaking when you see this fishing industry. People have invested, their life's work in it to be, seriously impacted. I know the one, the president of the Charter Association there, he said he doesn't know if he can survive another year. So it's on everybody's radar. It's a matter of how quickly we can move.
We're talking about Great Lakes Week and this month's biggest environmental stories with Great Lakes commentator Gary Wilson. So another conference, of course, in Chicago, it kicks off later today, Healing Our Waters. It's hosted by a coalition of environmental groups. Do you think the conversation there is going to be significantly different from the commission's conference, or will it be pretty much more of the same?
They'll hit some of the issues that the commission has been taking up, Melissa, but the Healing Our Waters Coalition is almost singularly focused on securing federal money for Great Lakes restoration, and they've been pretty successful at that. They also will localize some of their agenda items, but they tend to delve a little bit more into the scientific weeds so than the commission does. They're looking at topics like urban infrastructure, conservation. These are all good topics, but not necessarily spellbinders for the general public.
You had a recent column for Great Lakes Echo previewing the conference, and you described the Great Lakes community as a, quote, stay-between-the-lines bunch that favors collaboration over confrontation. What exactly did you mean by that?
Yeah, that's one of my ongoing themes, Melissa, and thanks for bringing it up. The broader community, the Great Lakes community, tends to favor a strategy that avoids confrontation. It would rather work with the polluters or the politicians who tend to turn a blind eye to environmental issues, to try to affect change versus confronting them. It's generally called the inside game, especially when they're working with politicians. It's rare that you'll hear Great Lakes advocates publicly criticize elected officials. There is a fear of losing access and influence. Other organizations, Food and Water Watch, and to some extent the Natural Resources Defense Council, have a bit of a different approach. They feel that when you're kind of playing the inside game, you have to make too many compromises to be effective. There's no right or wrong in this, but the Great Lakes community is especially focused on playing this inside game.
Finally, we have to get the oil question in here. Enbridge had an emergency response exercise for its controversial Line 5 pipeline that runs through the Straits of Mackinac. And roughly at the same time, Michigan Senators Debbie Stabenow and Gary Peters were introducing legislation that would ban shipments of crude oil on the Great Lakes. What do you think is driving that proposed legislation?
Well, it's the continuing spotlight that's on the Straits of Mackinac pipeline that has been in the news in some form for 2 years now. And I think there's a perception that various state and federal agencies are moving too slow. The senators, especially Senator Peters, I think they want to be preemptive here. When it comes to shipping oil on the Great Lakes in a vessel, which doesn't generally happen now. And also there are, keeping a spotlight on Enbridge. Everybody remembers that, that terrible Kalamazoo disaster from a few years ago. So I think the two senators are trying to be proactive and preemptive, and I think that's a good thing.
Gary Wilson is a Great Lakes commentator who is in Chicago covering the annual Great Lakes Week conferences and giving us his take on September's biggest environmental stories. Gary, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Melissa. Bye-bye.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Current State on WKAR. It is homecoming week here at MSU. East Lansing will be welcoming plenty of alumni back into town. One person, however, is less concerned about first-string quarterbacks than she is about the four strings she will have in front of her on Saturday night. And joining me now is Current State's Jamie Paisley to talk about her. Hey, Jamie.
Hi, Melissa. I spoke with Hannah Holman. She is the cellist with the New York City Ballet. She's also principal cellist with the Quad Cities Orchestra in Davenport, Iowa. And she'll be in town with Maestro Stephen Osmond, with whom I also spoke with, for Saturday's season-opening concert of the Jackson Symphony Orchestra. Now, what would prompt Ms. Holman to risk, you know, homecoming weekend traffic here in mid-Michigan to head to Jackson?
I'm from Jackson, yes.
When I spoke with Maestro, he wasn't sure, was it high school that you started performing with the Jackson Symphony?
Yeah, that's right. I think I played my junior and senior year of high school.
That's fairly intimidating.
It was fun. Yeah, it was great.
He brought you up also back, I guess, a few years ago for the Elgar, right?
I've done the Elgar there, and I've also done the Brahms double.
Mm.
I think that was the last time, which was, I can't remember, it might have been 2000. So it's been a long time. It's so exciting that I get to come back. Maestro Stephen Osmond and I have long talked about doing Dvorak in Jackson. And, I don't know, for about 15 years, whenever I've seen him, like, okay, we're going to do that Dvorak sometime. So it's finally happening.
And how long have you had the Dvorak in your hands?
Oh, wow. Well, that would be telling. I mean, well, first of all, it's the most fantastic cello concerto. You know, it's one of those pieces that you study forever, and then you get to keep revisiting it as you mature.
And after growing up in Jackson, cellist Hannah Holman went to the Eastman School in Central New York. But a return to mid-Michigan was not long in the coming.
I transferred to Michigan State, and I was pre-med for a year in the Lyman Briggs College there, and then music one. I couldn't deal with my physics classes anymore, and I just wanted to practice all the time. So I got my undergrad finished at Michigan State, and I think that's really where I started studying Dvorak with Owen Carman, who was the fellow professor at the time. And then I went to Boston and did my master's at New England Conservatory with Fritz Mag, and I studied it again there, probably, and got some different insights from a different teacher.
So when it comes to the Dvorak cello concerto, you've got the three movements, and I love the first movement. It's just, you know, very eloquent.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any sort of attachment to any of the three, the moment that you're like, that's my time to shine?
I have to say, for me, I kind of feel the heart of the piece in the second movement, especially in the kind of cadenza moment in the middle of the second movement. You know, he takes us on such a journey from majestic and big to very personal and then all the way back and forth again.
Which makes sense, since in the history of it, there's a certain lost love that comes out.
Right, exactly, right. And I think there's a quote from a song in the second movie.
Yeah, it was the favorite of his would-be girlfriend.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And it comes out, yeah.
Right.
Now, while we're on the topic of Hannah, the Bring Them Home series, how long has that been going on?
Well, it's been going on a long time.
That's Maestro Stephen Osmond, who is director of the Jackson Symphony Orchestra.
About 15 or 20 years ago, we had a series called the Jackson 8, which came about because there are a lot of accomplished musicians that grew up in Jackson have gone off to have major careers. Bob Spring, one of the premier clarinet professors and performers in the country. We had, actually, there were two other clarinetists at the time. Jeff Zook is from Jackson. He's the piccolo player with the Detroit Symphony. I put it all together because people would always come, why don't you bring this person? Why don't you bring that person? So I said, okay, they're all coming, two a year over a four-year period. And so this year, we're just sort of going back to that with Hannah, and she was one of the original Jackson Eight. In addition to that, Chris Etzinger is a fine pianist. He's on the faculty at St. Olaf, I believe, in Minnesota. A terrific solo career. So he's coming back as part of that. So we love bringing people back. They have an audience. There's a certain enthusiasm in the air. I mean, we love bringing people from, you know, other, with other backgrounds as well, but we stick a lot of close to home. Sort of the subtitle of the program is Joy and Sorrow, and so we're trying to sort of intermix a little bit. We're starting off with the Shostakovich Festival Overture, which is just, you know, about as joyous as you could get. And then from there we go to the Valse Triste of Sibelius, which to me is one of the most intimate personal pieces. I mean, whenever we play that or I look at it, try and play it on the piano or whatever, I just feel like there's a real connection between Sibelius and myself that has nothing to do with anything else. I mean, it's just one of those amazingly intimate, just goes right to your heart kind of pieces. And that's followed by the March to the Scaffold. We try to, again, we're exploring these ranges of emotion. And that has obviously a little fear, a little suspense, and all that kind of thing. And then that's followed by the Barber Adagio for Strings, which we all know and love, and even people who don't know what it is know it and love it. That sorrowful, introspective, terribly passionate, emotional piece to Mars, the bringer of war, and to end the first half. And of course, that's just, you know, that's the kind of piece that really inspires you to, I mean, also being a little scary, but just, and I hate to say militaristic kind of passion, which is not what we're looking for these days. We'd like to go the other way. But anyway, it does have a very gripping sense of empowerment to people.
So let me ask a fairly base question. So when I program the classical music that goes on the radio, I'm dealing with a very distracted audience. You know, they're driving, they're right at work, etc. And when you have an audience who you're programming for is very, you know, dedicated, how do you go about that in crafting just even one concert?
Well, that's a good question. I think a conductor has his primary creative outlet isn't necessarily composing, performing as a soloist, but it is programming. And you have to do, it used to be a lot harder here than it is now. I mean, I had to pick pieces that the orchestra could play 38 years ago. I mean, we did a lot of Haydn, a lot of Mozart and Beethoven, and now we can do virtually anything. We've played the Rite of Spring, it's been a while, the Mahler symphonies. So it's, but back to your question, the capability of the orchestra, not so much a problem anymore, but to engage the audience, to keep them well-paced, having them, you know, be inspired. Music has such a power, you know, over people to really affect them emotionally as well as intellectually, but mostly emotionally. And to I try on each concert to take them from one of those emotions to another, to another. They don't all appreciate, you know, sonata form. And so and sometimes they want to maybe take a little nap. But it's basically just to give them a spark within them, something that's going, they're going to remember, and not necessarily hum on the way home, but that'll tap into themselves and find a you know, a chord, if you will, that will be resonant with them.
Maestro, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure, Jamie, and we hope to see you down here again.
You can see the Jackson Symphony Orchestra with Maestro Stephen Osmond with their season opening concert, Joy and Sorrow, at the Potter Center in Jackson College, and their guest soloist, a
Jackson native Hannah Holman this Saturday at 7:30 p.m. You can find more information at jacksonsymphony.org. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, a group of MSU alumni spent a month this summer traveling the country in search of stories about death, religion, and the supernatural. Then they turned those stories into the first season of The Loon Cast. We'll talk to two of the creators of the new Detroit podcast about what they learned along the way. Plus, food, water, and shelter are basic needs, but for many in our community, so are diapers. And for this week's Neighbors in Action, we talked to local nonprofit Mid-Michigan Diaper Bank, which is working to distribute diapers to the Greater Lansing families who use them. That and more coming up tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks also to Mark Bayshore, Scott Pohl, April Van Buren, Jamie Paisley, Katie Cook, and Drew Hill. Get Current State delivered straight to your smartphone every morning. Just subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us on social media. We're at KAR Current State on Twitter and on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. I'm Melissa Benmark, filling in for Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.